But we chose this field. We wanted to be neurosurgeons. The risk you take when you are often operating at the edge is that there are some patients you cannot pull back. The highs and lows of neurosurgery become near addictive over time.
I want to thank you all for listening to the second in this podcast for pediatric neurosurgery. I'm Heather Spader at the University of New Mexico. I have with me my colleagues, Rob Bolo, the University of Utah, and Vijay Ravindra from the Naval Medical Center in San Diego. We are very pleased today to have Dr. Jay Wellens join us, and he's a very prominent pediatric neurosurgeon who is currently the chief of pediatric neurosurgery at Vanderbilt. And he has a very long list of accomplishments that he's done in pediatric neurosurgery. He has been very prominent in promoting research and improving the field with research, as well as training residents and fellows. He received his medical degree from the University of Mississippi Medical School, and you will hear that accent throughout this podcast. He did his residency.
You can modulate that as needed, Heather.
So you can go from Mississippi to North Carolina, so it's a little bit less, yeah. And then Tennessee.
That's right. No Boston. There's no Boston. Right.
He did his residency at Duke and finished that in 2001. He did his fellowship at the University of Alabama and then completed that in 2002 and stayed in Alabama for 10 years. And then he came to Vanderbilt in 2012. Despite all of his great accomplishments, we are here to talk about a new book that he wrote, and it talks about pediatric neurosurgery. He has written articles for the New York Times, and his new book that's coming out is called All That Moves Us, A Pediatric Neurosurgeon, His Young Patients and Their Stories of Grace and Resilience. We've all been lucky enough to be able to read this book, and we're going to talk to Dr. Wellens about it. And his experiences and why he wrote it. And we're very excited to have you today. And we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Heather. I really appreciate that introduction. And it's great to see Vijay. I'm really honored and grateful that you guys would have the interest in the book and allow me to come on and talk a bit about it. Thank you.
So Rob, I think we will start. I think you have the first question, and then we'll go from there. And we definitely want you to do some readings from the book. And overall, you know, I think all of us, when we talked about the book, we talked about how there's a shared common experience among pediatric neurosurgeons. And I think one of the things we want to talk about today is what is that shared experience and how do we experience that? So Rob, do you want to go ahead?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Wellens. We really appreciate your time. And I think we all really enjoyed reading the book. I think speaking personally, it was emotional. Certainly many of the stories and experiences and the narrative brought me to tears at different times. And I just absolutely loved it. And I'm excited to discuss it further. But one question that came up was at the end of the book, you talk about the rationale and inspiration for writing it. And I was wondering if you could just take a few minutes to elaborate a little bit more about that. Like what inspired you to do this, your background in English and literature and an interest in writing. Do you think this is something, you know, we should do more of as a specialty? Do you have plans for other books?
Yeah, all great questions. So you know, I was, obviously I talk about this some in the book, as you know, but I was an English major back in college at Ole Miss, which is, Center for Southern Literature. You can't go to the, you know, to a restaurant or really to the bathroom without seeing some reference to William Faulkner in Oxford, Mississippi. But I really had the opportunity to work with some fantastic professors, some actually in British and Anglo-Irish literature that were there from Oxford and Cambridge, studying some of the similarities between British and Irish literature and Southern literature at the time. And then also I had the opportunity to take an invited class, or had to be approved class with Barry Hanna and then Ellen Douglas, both just really fantastic Southern writers that had an impact on me. You know, Barry Hanna didn't give me anything higher than a B+. And he said, I need more conflict in my writing. Go out and live some conflict, Jay. And so, you know, here we are 30 years later. I think there's been some interesting things that have happened between now and college, more than just having long hair and wearing tie-dye t-shirts. And then I got into, always, you know, enjoyed medicine and went into medical school, honest to goodness, to be a family medicine doctor and move back to Mississippi and get paid in chickens and, you know, vegetables, just because that's kind of what I'd seen growing up, and just got enamored with neurosurgery and gross anatomy lab and the neuroanatomy lab. I remember dissecting out the brachial plexus and just finding it like macrame. You know, I was, it was just went on. It was kind of full speed ahead. And so I've just had the opportunity to have a wonderful career. My time at University of Alabama in Birmingham with Jerry Oakes and Paul Grabb and Jeff Blount and Jim Johnson. And that was a terrific part of my career, wonderful partners, really was able to do research and clinical cases. And I was very fortunate to be mentored well and partnered well. And then the opportunity came to come to opportunity arose to come to Vanderbilt, and, you know, just with Reed Thompson, really believing that he was a chair, has your back and supports you, we've been able to really grow this division. And so I guess I say all that to say, you know, I just kind of was like warp nine for, you know, 18 years, I guess 17 years of my career, just full speed ahead between HCRN and the wonderful influence those folks have had on me and the other research, and then being able to have some leadership positions here at Vanderbilt and being program director and all that. And, you know, all of a sudden, I found myself going from warp nine to, like a dead stop. And that was when I had this tumor in my leg. Folks may remember me kind of limping around at one of the section meetings one year. And I was on bed rest for 2.5 months. You know, there's only so much Netflix you can watch at that point. My sister Sarah said, you know, you should write some of these stories that you tell us, you know, in a HIPAA-approved fashion, I might add. So I started to just catalog some of the things I remembered from medical school. I used to keep these little day journals where I would just write like 2 or 3 words down, like fish hook guy or axe man. And axe man ends up being one of the stories in the book called A Mississippi Nick. I just spent some time doing that. And then I gradually kind of would sit down and write one of those stories. And it was, you know, from medical school in the first 10 years and the last 7 years of my career. I sent one to my wife, which is really funny when you live in the same house as somebody and you say you sent them something, but I emailed it to her. Because I was on bed rest and I think my family was sick of me. And she said, hey, this is a pretty funny story. And so I was like, well, you know, Mel's, I mean, people that know my wife, like she's a, you know, critic and in a good way, just in case she's listening. And so I then sent it to my sister, Sarah, who's the one that said, you should write some of these stories. And lo and behold, Sarah's like a really well-connected person. She's like, when I say she's an enabler in the finest sense. So she sent it to her friend who had been on the editorial board of the New York Times and who said, you need to send this in. And so I thought, okay. And so I sent it in, and lo and behold, it got accepted. It was a story about when I was on a flight. You know, we all have kind of flight stories, and it involved a really bloody nose, me only having one suit to go up and see Susan Durham when she was at Vermont and speak at her shop, and end up putting a tampon in this guy's nose on the airplane, and the bleeding stopped, and it was just kind of funny. And so a lot of my colleagues wrote and said, hey, you're a funny writer. That's great, you know. And my editor at the Times, just an amazing editor, a guy named Peter Catapano, he said, you know, you're a pediatric neurosurgeon. I know you have something serious. And so I wrote the story that was published, the second piece in the New York Times, that was about a girl who had a subdural hematoma and ended up being flown to us via a military helicopter. And after that, I had a lot of emails from folks about how just around the world, like, you know, our emails are public, just about how much that story meant to them and how much they got a sense of hope from it. And it was right as the pandemic was starting to kind of raise its head. And so I just began to think about the fact that well, we could all use hope, and we all have these common stories. And so from that, you know, came a series of agents, and I chose one person who had been the editor of Esquire, and he said, you know, write me 5,000 words on why you want to be a pediatric neurosurgeon, and don't punctuate it. Who's your favorite author? James Joyce. Okay, great. Don't punctuate it. Don't capitalize it. Don't edit it. Just write it and send it. And so I sat down one day and just wrote that thing and sent it to him like, oh God, here it goes. And hit enter. And that ended up being the proposal for a book that actually is the introduction in the book, The Littlest Among Us.
I do have to interrupt and say, I'm glad you didn't decide to use the James Joyce school of writing for your actual book, because I don't think I would have made it through. I was a liberal arts major at UVA, and so they also worship Faulkner there, because it's like a
Southern,
and Faulkner was on faculty there, and you know, but some of those Southern writers, boy, they go on and on and on. So I have to
just
say,
like I'm read, doing now, right?
You know? No, but having read your book, it does not have that quality of Southern writing. Okay. So that is it's easy read.
That's good. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah. So you know, that's how the book came about, and it's been just a wonderful opportunity to think about why I became a pediatric neurosurgeon. And, you know, one of the most important things to me was, like, I didn't write this book to be like, hello, and by the way, come see me in Vanderbilt. It's not it at all. You know, it's like, it's about the patients, and it's about the stuff that, you know, what I've learned and what all of us have learned from our patients, you know, over the last however many years of our careers. And, you know, I really hope that my, you know, colleagues in pediatric neurosurgery get that I'm just trying to, I really want to just shine a light on what we do in a really positive and a real way, because neurosurgery in general is a place where we're at this, you know, junction of life and death, not to be, you know, it's a cliche, but it's true. And so, and then you add the pediatric part to it, and it's really 250 of us that live this. So I'm hopeful that, you know, not only do the folks out there really get a sense of kind of wonder and awe and emotion, understanding from it, but that, you know, my colleagues in pediatric neurosurgery feel like that it's a good representation of what we do. That's really important to me. So not to be Faulkner-esque, but I think I've rambled enough with that question, but that's really the story. I mean, it came about from never knowing, you know, like I really had this flat out, you know, existential crisis when I had this thing in my leg that was thought to be malignant and ended up being benign. And all of a sudden, when you go through that, you kind of realize, you know, I think I said in the book, like, you know, hey, dumbass, like, this is going to be okay. And so it just was a good opportunity for me to kind of change tack a little bit. And it's been really important for me to do this.
One of the other things that I was struck with that hit me personally, in addition to being liberal arts majors, you and I have the unfortunate commonality that both of our parents died of ALS. And it's a pretty horrific way to die, because you just are neurologically all there, but your body fails you. And reading through your description of being a resident while this event happened was somewhat disturbing to me, because you were never given the time to really, I think it seems like, to process in a normal way, the way other people get that opportunity. And that seemed really sad to me. And I guess my question was, if you had a resident that went through that situation now, how would you deal with it? And what would you maybe do differently? And what have we, I mean, have we evolved since you had that experience?
Yeah, no, well, I think first of all, I remember you sharing that with me. It is terrible. I mean, you know, it's a grief that, you know, I've carried, I'm sure you carry, you know, for 25 years. And at the time, I basically buried myself in my work. Those are the days before work hour restrictions. And so you're right. I think to some extent, it's taken me 25 years to really fully come to terms with what my father meant to me and what he had on my life. And the bits and pieces about this book that have my father in it are really good to write. This felt really important for me, just from moving from one space into another. And I think I say in the book, you know, like I definitely saw myself in the grieving families that I've cared for. And I definitely saw my father and some of the children and some of the other patients, you know, that I cared for as a resident and as an attending. So this was an immensely important thing for me. And I think that when my mother passed away of the different etiology of lymphoma, I think I was much more, you know, open and emotional and able to engage in it. Although, you know, I still am processing that now, but that's okay. You know, grief is not something that you just hammer out in a week. I think it's something that you have to allow to kind of just wrap around you and move through in whatever time, you know, you're supposed to, as long as you're moving through it, not sitting in it or not refusing to. And that's kind of where I sat before, I think. So in terms of, you know, as a resident, you know, Tim George was a, you know, had a pretty remarkable impact on me and was always someone who knew the right way to be and the right thing to say. And you know, the faculty there, when all of this happened, they, you know, had empathy, but at the end of the day, it's your grief to move through. And I think now a resident who had something like this to move through, you know, a program director before, and then now in the other roles I have now, I mean, I think clearly it's just you just offer yourself and your office as a safe space, and you allow them to know that it's a place that they can come and talk through things. It's a place that they can, you know that people have had this experience before. You know, I think that we're a lot better nowadays. I mean, it's not just work hours, but we're a lot better nowadays about recognizing what's healthy for our residents and what's not, Heather. You know, I think when about the fact that I have, you know, somebody that I guess the 1970s term for it is a therapist or a life coach. What if I was like, you know, the term is ECT. No, I mean, yeah, it's a life coach, and that person really, really helps me a lot. And, that's what I want my kids to feel like, that it's okay to get help. I think that's what I would say in answer to your question, is that it's okay to be sad. You don't have to just put your nose down to the grindstone. And, you know, we have the ability to help people move through this probably in a healthier way than I did at the time. But, you know, like I said, I think things happen for a reason. And, you know, I'm really, you know, the three or four parts that I write in here about my dad, really important to me to have gotten out there.
No, I think it's one of those touching, like you can sense that when you're reading the book, how important he was to you and to your life. And I think it made me sad to read about how you did not have time to really grieve that. On the flip side, that was kind of the way residency is.
I might just add to that for a second, which is that I saw, you know, I think the issues you touch on in terms of training are really important and suggest an evolution in our humanity in this specialty. But I also think that, you know, when I was reading the book, I was reflecting that, you know, in neurosurgery, we don't, you know, we're competitive people, smart people go into this field, but we don't have a monopoly on those things. And there's plenty of smart, competitive people in lots of different fields. And so what makes us unique and the stories you're telling, and I feel like, at least to me, part of it is, you know, we sort of step into the breach and help families through their emotional situations. That's, I think you use the term fresh nightmare, or just the most emotionally biggest upheavals they may ever experience, things their lives will be, you know, warped around. And that's a privilege and something that I think we all get joy and learn from. But at the same time, you know, neurosurgery steals time. It steals time from our loved ones and our families and the people that are important to us. And you turn around and a lot of that time is gone because it's such an in-depth focused specialty and you spend so much of your own time doing that. And there's a dichotomy and a trade-off, and, you know, we're sort of making all that in real time. And that really came through to me. And it seemed a lot like some of those parts were sort of a letter to your father and, you know, that talking about that time lost through these rich experiences, but still, you know, there's a big trade-off to be made.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right about all of that, Rob. I like that term, we step into the breach. You know, certainly, I think that what I said was this fresh nightmare that we've unleashed upon them, you know, with the truth that we're speaking to them about what's going on with their children. I have this memory of all people about Herb Fuchs, which I think this might be a good moment. Can I read this real quick? Would this be all right? So this is a part of the book that we refer to. It's the part that kind of goes over the anatomy. Abhaya Kulkarni, who was an early reader of the book, called this the whale chapter. Because in Moby Dick, you know, you're reading the narrative and all of a sudden there's this weird chapter about whales. The first version of this was, you know, it read like, you know, Netter's Neuroanatomy written, not really, but we call this the whale chapter, but it's really just, it's about neuroanatomy, but it's told in stories. So this is the brainstem.
I thought every other chapter of Moby Dick was like that.
Yeah, you're right. There,
right? Yeah, you're right. And I wanted to say for the listeners, you didn't do that either.
yeah, right. Thank you. Just to clarify, he's not Faulkner. He's not,
right, exactly.
He's not Melville. Okay, right. Great. We're weaning it out. Yeah. It's still Hemingway. Okay. So it's important here to mention the deadliest of tumors in children, DIPG, diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma, that occurs in this tightly packed space, the brainstem. These children present with eye and facial movement issues, often weakness from the motor tract involvement passing to the spinal cord. The imaging ultimately done in response to these symptoms reveals the death sentence of a DIPG. Surgery is impossible. The tumor is intimately interwoven into the dense and critical structures of the pons. Radiation and chemotherapy together impart just over a 1 year survival at best. Burned into my memory from my residency days is the mother of a 12-year-old girl about to be told that her daughter had been diagnosed with a DIPG. They were in the clinic of one of my attending pediatric neurosurgeons, Herb Fuchs. Herb is very much the same now as he was then, tall and skinny, a tendency to tell the same story over and over, and loved by his patients. Once he had finished examining the girl, he subtly motioned for me to lead her out to sit with the nurses. As I did so, I noticed that she was a bit unsteady on her feet. I also remember looking back through the door as it was closing behind me to see Herb staring down at the ground. I know now he was gathering his nerves for what was to come. When I returned to the room minutes later, the mother had grabbed him by the lapels and was shaking him, sobbing that her daughter wanted to grow up to be a Supreme Court justice. And how in God's name could he be telling her this? I remember her reaching out to gently embrace her until her heaves subsided. A moment later, the woman stepped away to dab her eyes, regain control, and turn headlong into her fresh nightmare. When I see Herb today, closing in on retirement, always asking me how the better Dr. Wellens is doing, meaning my wife, I remember that very moment. I remember her pain, his grace, and that brief aftermath that I witnessed. I find myself even now hoping to live up to his example of how we are to show compassion and even love in the midst of the great and nearly unbearable pain that we must at times unleash upon our patients.
I think that passage is so much like the book, where you really tap into the pain that we feel and that we share with our patients. And, you know, I always think about when you come out of a surgery that, like, imagine a tumor that's lasted for 6 to 8 hours, and you walk out into that room and you see the parents, and it's the worst day of their life. And all they're doing is staring at that door for 6 to 8 hours for you to come out and say, your kid's okay. Kind of, except for the fact that you're right, like, you're about to embark in a path that you never anticipated for your beautiful child.
Yeah. You know, Al Cohen used to do this terrific talk. He had videos, of course, with Al, and where he had actors as patients. I don't know if any of you guys have seen that, but it's really masterful because Al does it with his typical humor. But, you know, he comes out in a way like how not to communicate to families. And it's like, well, the surgery was beautiful. I am an excellent surgeon. The margins were perfect. Now, you know, it's a medulloblastoma. It's malignant, but somebody else will figure that out. You know? And the parents are like, what? What are you talking about? He's like, yeah, hold on. And he gets on the phone. I mean, it's completely Al Cohen over the top, but it is like an antithesis of how we know deeply in our hearts. I mean, one of the stories called Stitches, I talk about this really wonderful six-year-old girl, you know, just had a wonderful, had an amazing impact on us, who, you know, presented blind. You know, we've all had a child like that, kind of late in the day, big tumor, and elected to take her to the OR for a resection. That you could see those thrombose blood vessels in the middle of it. You know, it's a GBM, you know, from the time course and her presentation and just the way it looks under the operating room microscope. You know, you celebrate, you want to be able to celebrate with them, to be able to say, look, you know, she's, you know, her vision's back. She could see this pen, she could see this watch, but you know, in your heart of hearts, what they're going to endure, you know, that's challenging. And that's part of what we do. We live this kind of metronomic like existence. And, you know, some of the chapters in the book are about that. And some of the chapters in the book are about a lot of hope, you know, that our patients can give us. Those that, you know, that come back from significant AVM ruptures, or those that come back from spinal cord injury, or those that come back from epidural hematomas or trauma, or, you know, all the different things that we care for in the midst of what we do. And so I think, you know, part of this is to show people outside of our field, that's what it's like. You know, there's the high highs and there's the low lows. And so, you know, when our therapists say you're supposed to live in the middle, you're like, what are you talking about, man? Like, for 25 years, we've been out here at the third, fourth standard deviations. What is the middle?
I think that kind of segues nicely, Dr. Wellens. First off, the book was just awesome. Really enjoyed it. And for three people who I think are at different stages of their career, me at the very beginning, Heather definitely kind of hitting her stride in the midpoint, and Rob, who's really kind of established, it all had different impacts on us in different ways. And I found it enormously comforting and therapeutic. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, this is kind of a two-part question, is, you know, in training and even in medical school, we're kind of taught to build up these scars. Everybody's got scars and we endure them and we keep them and we don't really talk about them. And what your book did for me was kind of reopen them in a good way, you know, and I wanted your opinion, just talk about that a little bit and how you think that should shape the way we treat trainees and fellows moving forward. I thought the greatest thing that I read in your book was that fireside chat that you had with your residents at your house about stories. And I thought that was such a cool thing. And I want to hear more about that.
Yeah. Well, Well, first of all, thanks a lot, Vijay. I appreciate you saying that. I agree, Rob is pretty senior. He's kind of rusty senior. But a couple of things to say that are relevant to that. One is, I write about in the introduction how, there is a writer who has written about, it's like a French writer. I need to look this up and know this, about how, you know, every surgeon has a graveyard. I don't really think of it so much as a graveyard as much as I think of it like, I have this green field that's just outside, you know, my visual frame of reference. And I really do have this image of this green field where, you know, you kind of go and it's a very peaceful place. And you have these memories that are hard, and I would kind of go and take the sod off the top, and, you know, dig a hole, take this really hard memory and put it in a box and wrap a chain around the box and put a lock around the box and put it down in the hole and then put the sod down on top of it and tamp it down. And it's a little mound, and it would be part of this kind of row of little mounds. And I would know that they were there and they were an important part of me. And that to some extent represents the scar. But then when you go back and you really think of these stories, you realize that they are a part of you. And when you begin to think about the people behind, and what the people showed you about grief, what they showed you about joy, you realize that while that's important to be able to put that there, it's also important to be able to talk about it. And so I concocted this idea, you know, there's a lot of medical schools that have narrative medicine. You know, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do post residency director. I took this position in clinical research for all the surgeons at Vanderbilt or whatever, for most of them. But I wanted to stay in touch with the residents. So as the book was getting done, I concocted this idea of narrative medicine, of this journal club that you referenced. And, you know, I had this idea like, hey guys, we're not going to read a paper from Journal of Neurosurgery Pediatrics. We're going to you guys just write a story. It could just be about a patient you took care of, you know, like one page, doesn't matter. Just write it down and we can just all talk about it. And it was actually, as I say that, a couple of the residents came up to me while we were operating at night when they were covering children's or something and say, hey, Dr. Wellens, what if we wanted to tell some stories too? Could we do that? And that's actually the genesis of it. I was like, yeah, well, we should do it. So my fear was I was going to have all these shish kebabs and like three residents show up. You know, I mean, 10 residents in the back porch where there's food. Others are on call and others have cases going late. 10 or 12, I can't remember how many it was. But the bottom line is everybody came with a story and everybody intently listened. And they were really moving stories. And it was about, you know, not only was it about sad things that we talked about here some, but it was about saves that made them feel like that they were good at what they did, that made them feel like they were doing important things for humanity. And it was in a safe space, just like it's a safe space to be able to say, I took this tiny feeding vessel and it ended up being a major perforator when I was taking the tumor out that I thought I could take out because it went into the tumor. I think it's also important to have a safe space to say, like, you know, I pushed this patient up to the angio suite myself and we did embolized this, you know, I mean, and removed this MCA clot. And, you know, she woke up and she went home the next day to her family, you know, who was so grateful. And, you know, it's hard to like go home and tell that story in a way that doesn't sound like you're ripping your chest off with the big S tattoo, you know. And so it was really meaningful to sit around in this communal space with our residents who just needed to share these stories. I'm really looking forward. I had the opportunity to read to some of the medical students here at Vanderbilt, Scott Zuckerman, who you mentioned, you know, and a guy named Aaron Yango Khan, who is actually going into Pete's neurosurgery too, but they put together this neurosurgery interest group and it ends up being like 25 or 30 students from here in Meharry. And they wanted me to come read one of my stories. And, you know, you have to learn how to like read and look up and read and look up. Well, at first I was, you know, just reading from the computer, the story that I'd written. And as I was finishing, I was like, I know I'm going to look up and they're all going to be asleep. You know, that's what's going to happen. It's okay, Jay. Don't worry about it. And I looked up and, you know, everybody is like, oh my gosh, this is so important for us to be able to do this. And so I'm really looking forward to part of writing a book is going around and talking about it. And so a lot of institutions are going to have me read to their medical students or read with their medical students or with their residents. And I'm really looking forward to that because I think establishing that now, Heather, it's a little bit like what you're talking about. You know, how would we approach things different? But if we can kind of establish the fact that we are not alone now, I think it will help people be able to process these stories as they move on in their career and be able to talk about these things. That's what I think.
Yeah. And I have to say, like, one of the things I really appreciated are the stories where it doesn't go right. And the reason is that we all have those stories, but we sort of keep them to ourselves or ruminate, or it must have been my fault, or I did this wrong, or, you know, and to read that, wait, Jay Wellens also had something go wrong. You know, I mean, it gives you some comfort. Sometimes the disease is the problem, you know, and you're in between the disease and a bad outcome, and there's not a lot you can do. But knowing, again, you know, we talked a little bit about this one, but the quote I always like from C.S. Lewis is, we read to know we are not alone. That was really how I felt with a lot of the passages in your book.
Thank you. I'm honored. I'm a big C.S. Lewis fan.
Me too.
In fact, I named this one, I write about her in the book, this wonderful girl named Hannah. She had to overcome, you know, the tumor that I was talking about that had this one little perforator that went into the tumor, you know, and I was trying to dissect it out, thinking maybe I could keep it off, and it just whispered into nothing. And there were 16 other branches that were fine. And I go out to talk to her family and I get that text and you look down and it's like, hey, the patient's not moving their right side or the left side. I'm like, excuse me, you know, and then you go back in and you realize that that perforator was like a real perforator. And, you know, you're going to get the tumor out, but at the same time, this just doesn't feel good that this has happened. And, you know, they're going to have a long road of recovery. And she's recovered. I mean, she's done amazing, but it's taken her some time and she's taken a little hit from it. But she's extraordinarily resilient. But I'm saying this to say that So she named her tumor Little Devil. And I really always thought that was hilarious. And then all of a sudden I had this thing. And so I decided to stay with the underworld motif, and I named it Wormwood, which is, you know, from tape letters. Yeah. Who's just, you know, Wormwood was his sole purpose was to bring about the fall of man. And so, you know, when I had this existential threat, I wrote Wormwood on a tennis ball and I put it over in the corner of the room. And I was like, one day I'm going to be able to get up and walk across the room and I'm going to be able to take that tennis ball and throw it out the window. So I did it.
Nice. Yeah, one of the other quotes that I really liked, and I think Vijay, I'll read the quote, and then I don't know if you want to add a quote or read from this, because I know you had some passages you wanted to read, but the constant beat of life and death decisions begins to change you in fundamental ways. Trust gives way to suspicion and care gives way to loathing. I don't know if you want to elaborate on that or a different quote, but I think that one struck us very meaningful.
Well, I think that's, you know, that's a place you get when you're in a place of moral burnout. I mean, I just remember it, you know, vividly as a resident, you know, just not call me again. You know, I cannot, you know, not just neurosurgery is closed for the evening, but, you know, I mean, after 17 consults, but like literally do not call me again. And, you know, I think back to my training a lot. I'm fortunate to be able to remember some of it, the part of when I was not asleep. Most of my, you know, it's so funny to see pictures of any holiday. We had friends, my wife was in medical school and, you know, they were living their life in medical school. And so it would be like a Valentine's party. And I would get there at, you know, 10:30 on a Friday, and there was this couch in the corner of the couch, and there, look, there's Jay asleep. And then it would be, there's New Year's. Hey, look, there's Jay asleep. And then, you know, it'd be like her birthday. And look, there's Jay asleep. I mean, literally we have like 50 pictures of me in the corner of this striped couch asleep, you know, for most of my residency. But anyway, so I wrote this, in a single hour of being on call as a neurosurgical resident, you can sit with an elderly woman in the emergency department to tell her that the brain hemorrhage her husband of 50 years just suffered while shaving is not survivable and no surgery will change that. Then, just afterward, you can be called to the pediatric ICU to place a life-saving drain in the brain of a 4-year-old girl dying from elevated intracranial pressure and watch as the child opens her eyes a few minutes later, squeezing her parents' hands. 1 hour, in the span of one single hour, those things can happen over and over and over in the weeks, then months, then 7 years of formal training. That job training, at least the part that deals in the intense and important human truths forged at the unspoken places we navigate, is never ending. Ultimately, one has no choice but to live with stress. Taking every third day and night call rotation made it seem like you were always either on call, post call, or getting ready to take call, which was indeed the case for 7 long years. Each beep of our pager would disrupt the flow of the operation, sometimes with a call back to the other party, be it trauma bay or ICU with a new emergency or a nurse with a question or a doctor with a consult. Regardless, one moment we were wrapped in the intricate landscape of this new world we desperately wanted to learn to navigate under the microscope or through the lens of an endoscope. The next, our attention was pulled away from the OR table to either relay an answer through the circulating nurse, lean our heads awkwardly into the telephone receiver being held just to the side of us while scrubbed, trying to get our ears on the receiver just so without contaminating ourselves, or on occasion, scrubbing out completely to manage a problem, taking us out of the OR indefinitely. As a resident, managing the chaos of the world outside the OR taxed every part of my being. Rapid-fire crises will do that. 6 or 7 things happening simultaneously, triaging them, ordering and managing by level of seriousness, thinking through each of them quickly enough to avoid having more issues pile up. Over time, that processing became second nature, and certainly part of it was the clinical presentations of patients and the anxiety and sadness that it brought. It was always there. But we chose this field. We wanted to be neurosurgeons. the risk you take when you are often operating at the edge is that there are some patients you cannot pull back. The highs and lows of neurosurgery become near addictive over time. Mere sadness is not enough. It must be gut-wrenching grief. Frustration turns to disdain for anyone not trying as hard as you, and joy becomes heightened beyond what can be considered normal. Spending a few hours off with friends pales in comparison with getting to tell a wife that her husband will live and wake up and come home after all. Thank you, doctor, and thank you for all the sacrifices you have made along the way. These days, the term burnout and moral injury are used to describe the place that doctors and other healthcare workers with patient responsibilities sometimes find themselves in. It's dangerous. Add a chronic lack of sleep and an environment of probing and second guessing, and you can begin to lose trust in everyone around you. The constant beat of life and death decisions begins to change you in fundamental ways. And this is what you mentioned before, Heather. Trust gives way to suspicion, care to loathing. But back then we had no labels for this, just the anger and the guilt. So, you know, I do think that we have moved into a different place. At least I feel that in the institutions that I've been at, and as I talk to colleagues, that, you know, I think that we understand that, you know, we can't put ourselves strongly, you know, we can't put ourselves in those positions on a continual basis. I think, you know, anybody, doesn't matter what your resilience is going to get burnt out. I mean, I always make the point that on the flip side, you know, when you plant a tree, sure, it's about the tree and how great the tree is and the potential of the tree and how the tree is going to have these great leaves. That's all important, but it's also about the ground that you plant the tree in. And, you know, does it have water in it? Does it have nutrients in it? Is it a good ground for the tree to grow in? So it's the same thing on the flip side. You know, we all have this degree, this level of resilience and tolerance that we can handle, but then if what's the environment around us? And if we aren't supported, we don't have colleagues that we can rely on, we don't have senior partners or chairman or other people that we can rely on, it makes it a lot harder. And I think it makes this threshold, drops the seizure threshold, you know, it just makes it where we're more apt to go to those places. And I think we have to be able to modulate ourselves. And I think we have to be able to modulate at each other and support each other. You know, I'm sure it's like this for you guys. I mean, it's been ridiculously busy, you know, over these intervals. And, you know, I think, you know, you just have to be able to know yourself and know your partners and know the people that you're training and give them support. That's what I think.
When I read that quote, it was, to me, it was a coping mechanism, right? You thought that way because you had to. And I think, you know, what you've done with this book and hopefully have such a positive impact is you've kind of opened the door for a different way of thinking. And I think that's really exciting. I just wanted to bring up another point here, and you're kind of on the other side of the spectrum a little bit. And this is something that Heather and Rob and I have talked about to some degree. You know, we're in the age of information overload when it comes to Instagram and Facebook and Google and all these things. And then there's the traditional way of disseminating information, like writing an article that goes in the New York Times or writing a book like you've done. And I just want your overall thoughts and how you look at the way we disseminate, let's call it information to the lay press. And what role we have in that and what kind of responsibility we have in that.
Yeah, that's a great question, BJ. I mean, I'm definitely grateful. Well, I will start with being grateful to a couple of people. I mean, I'm grateful to John Jane Sr. for the invitation to be on JNSP's editorial board. And I'm really grateful, like many of us in our field, to Jim Rutka. But for me, it was just his ability to let me, you know, to kind of let me write editorials that weren't traditional for JNSP's. I mean, you know, it's not like we didn't review the data, but there was a little bit of not Melville, but you know, there was a little bit of stuff at the beginning and the end just to make it maybe a little bit more interesting. But the point is that I think I began to see there that people, even in our field, like our field to be promoted in a way for people to understand. I don't think I'm being clear yet. So let me get to the place where I think I'm clear on this. And then I think all of us really strive to be able to, at least most people I know, really strive to be able to communicate to their patients. You know, how many times have you said, so this is your brain, this is the cerebrum, the cerebellum, and the brainstem, and this is the bottom of the cerebellum. This is called the cerebellar tonsil. It's not like the tonsils in the back of your throat, but the cerebellar tonsils can go down outside the skull, you know, and be able to explain that. And I think we, at least I have learned how important that narrative is, and the ability to explain people, explain things to people that are outside of our field. So I think I have this sense that people within our field, I just say within pediatric neurosurgery, and I think within other aspects of medicine too, the ability to communicate things that not just in a epidemiological and biostatistical fashion. I think it's important to be able to provide a narrative within our field, and I think there's a place for that. And then to people outside of our field, I think we all see as pediatric neurosurgeons how important it is to communicate with your patient's parents. You know, it's important to be able to communicate to the children and to the patients, and no doubt in all these fields. But you know, you're talking to these parents who have birthed these children or adopted these children or made this family in whatever way that they made this family a family. And now their child has something, and you've got to communicate what that is to them in a way that they understand. And they not only understand that what the problem is and what their child needs, but they need to understand that for the most part, you're going to be able to get them through it to the other side and give them some hope. And that hope and that resilience, all that may look different than what they're used to, but there is going to be an other side to this. And there's a chapter, an essay in the book called The Other Side, that just kind of talks about getting to that other side. So, you know, I think that your point is really outstanding about, you know, I can sometimes get in a cycle, you know, like check my email, check my test messages, see what my Twitter account's happening. I had to join Instagram. So what's Instagram? Oh, let me check my email again, you know, and then I'll go back to my texting, you know. And I tell you, I do worry about information overload. And I have to, like I have on my phone, personally, I have this, that's supposed to be like an emoji of me right there. So that when I look at it, it's like me meditating. It's like, just chill out just for a second. Okay. Don't go into that cycle. So that's it is the coin of the realm in some extent to be able to communicate with people. But I think we need to figure out, I mean, they're teaching our adolescents in schools how to set the screen aside. And I think that we need to know how to do that. Okay. That's that. That's 3 points. The fourth point is, you know, I like the written word, and I think it's important that we communicate via, whether it's through public policy and our impact on public policy, or whether it's through telling stories. And, you know, Vijay, I'm sure, and Heather and Rob, I mean, I'm sure that like hospitals have come to you guys and say, we want to tell a story about one of your patients, you know, and it's like, you know, 7-year-old twin, you know, Loretta was walk her dog one day when she held her hands to her head and fell with a headache. And it was an AVM, and she came to our hospital, and it was resected by our neurosurgeons and recovered in the ICU, and they went to rehab, and here they are in a triathlon. And, you know, that's like a really important message, an ability to be able to tell those stories. I will, if y'all indulge me, can I do one more? It's about the cerebellum. This is part of the, I don't know, I'm reading from the Moby Dick chapter again, the whale chapter, but let's see. So in situations where there's an acute rupture of a vascular abnormality, like an AVM or cavernous malformations, the development of hydrocephalus is not gradual, but rapid and urgent and deadly if untreated. Megan was an 8-year-old who woke up one morning with a terrible headache. Within minutes, she sat up to vomit, then fell over into her mother's arms and became unresponsive. After a frantic 911 call, an ambulance arrived to take her to our children's hospital emergently. En route, she began to seize and her heart rate became unstable. 90 minutes after it all began, Megan was wheeled into our trauma bay in the ED, where a large team had gathered in anticipation of her arrival. She was close to death. Her rapid CT scan showed a large blood clot in her cerebellum causing hydrocephalus. We suspected a ruptured cavernous malformation, a vascular lesion similar to an AVM, but there was no time for an MRI or further imaging. Our senior neurosurgery resident placed a drain in her brain right there in the trauma bay to drain off the fluid and relieve the pressure that had built up. Megan stirred, but still the clot was too large. We quickly decided to get her up to the operating room, turned her prone, shaved the back of her head, and proceeded to open the skin over the back of the head and remove the overlying bone and take out the plum-sized blood clot that was pressing on her brain. The moment we took it out, her vital signs began to normalize. This should be common for all of us, you know. After surgery, she opened her eyes in the ICU and tracked her mom walking around the bed. But Megan couldn't lift her arms without a pronounced tremor. Once recovered enough to be off the breathing machine, she didn't speak. It was like she could not coordinate the effort to do it. She couldn't sit up, her body shimmying from lack of control. We had saved her life, but this state was difficult for her and her mother and heartbreaking for us to see. What had we brought her back into? Fortunately, Megan was a child with the same immense potential for recovery that most children have. Also, fortunately, Megan and her mother never left her side, who willed her through rehabilitation out of state and who remains a force for adequate resources for children of all ages to have access to rehab centers after brain injury. I last saw Megan at a local triathlon. She was the symbolic first competitor, and I saw her with her number one race bib headed off for the swim. I realized quickly that she was symbolic in name only. Megan was there to win. I cheered with her mother when she crossed the finish line, and I stood amazed, as Megan told my children, in her own words, of her ordeal, and then of my role in it. My daughter, Fair, looking back and forth from Megan, a girl her age, to me, and for the first time saw the reality behind the stories that she occasionally heard at the dinner table as to why Dad had to leave. Megan, her mother, and I remain close as they send me photos of her continued milestones, and I get to watch her grow into the young woman she was meant to be. So I read that just because I just have to say, I think it's important for us to tell stories. It's important for us to tell stories of grief and how we handle it, and it's important for us to tell stories of joy. There's a wonderful book that was a series of interviews with the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu when Desmond Tutu was alive. And a lot of what they talk about, it's about the aspects of gratitude and joy. And a lot of what they talk about is the importance of celebration and of telling stories and of celebrating good things, not only for yourself, but for the community that you're a part of. And so I think that's another really important part of how we do things. Sometimes it's hard to get a lot of joy across in a 160 character tweet, but when you're able to get to an institution like the New York Times or Penguin Random House with the amazing editor, Mark Warren, that I've had the opportunity to work with. I mean, you know, these are people that really recognize the power of these stories and the importance in the telling of them. You know, like I said, you know, like I was saying, like both the fact that we all have grief, we're not immune to suffering. We can be good people or bad people, but we're not immune to suffering. So it's important for us to recognize that, but also to celebrate the joy, to celebrate the parts that are the real, just vivid examples of resilience and hope and kind of grace that we see in every day. And we really live that as pediatric neurosurgeons. And I just think it's such a powerful thing for us to have the opportunity to write it down. And, you know, honest to goodness, Vijay, I just really feel honored, like to some extent, like, you know, I had this exposure to these writers and I lived this super intense life for, you know, like 25 years. And then all of a sudden I was just knocked on my butt, literally, and have had the opportunity to reflect and get this stuff down. You know, like for the public record, for people to see it.
I think, you know, your term narrative medicine, I think, is so important to a lot of people. And I think it's a brand new field of medicine and even newer in neurosurgery that we really need to take on, you know, head on. And I think you will inspire a lot of change in the way that we deal with our own problems, with tough cases, tough outcomes. And certainly, you know, I thought it was just fantastic. You took our everyday experiences and you made them just, they're right there. You know, it wasn't, it wasn't secondary. It was right in front of you. And I can't tell you how much I appreciated that.
WJ, thank you. I will say that I had the opportunity to, I mean, obviously I talked to the families, you know, about these stories, and 100% of the families that I talked to said, you know, tell my baby story. And it's one young woman whose child, it's in the essay about the little boy who had the gunshot wound, who we almost lost in the OR, but then survived at KJ. She said, Dr. Wellens, I will not read your story. You must sit here and read it to me. And so I sat at the table across from her. And yet that story is a graphic story. You know, you guys remember this bleeding from everywhere, you know, this, that, and the other. And I would look up intermittently and I would say, are you okay? She would say, I'm okay. You keep reading it. And then, you know, by the end of it, you know, I told her, I said, Nadama, I'll change KJ's name. I'll change his age. I'll change his gender. I will not run the story at all. It is your story. And she looked up at me and she said, Dr. Wellens, you tell my baby's story. You tell it for all the world to hear. And, you know, that's just what I keep thinking about these stories. You know, I feel like that the opportunity to tell these children's stories is what they taught me and what all of our patients teach all of us on the screen and everywhere, and my partners down here and Vanderbilt and all these medical centers that we all belong to. You have to remember it's a two-way street, you know, and sometimes, you know, it's this concept that, you know, we believe that we are giving, but we really are receiving, right? So I appreciate you saying that, BJ. Thank you.
I think, Jay, I wanted to underscore the comment that BJ made and your great answer to it. And I'm always reminded of the movie Hurt Locker. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but you know, he defuses these bombs, these IEDs in Iraq, and then he is on, he's on furlough and, you know, and back in the States, and he's in a supermarket, and there's a scene that resonates with me because it just feels so out of place in ordinary life. And I think in neurosurgery, you know, we live these very intense emotional experiences, and I think that, you know, there's a big barrier to us in terms of feeling comfortable sharing those with people in our regular lives, and or sharing the patient stories of hope and that move us and you know, bring us back to work day in and day out. But there's a need, and I think your book really showed me that you know, and I also love this concept of narrative medicine. I think we need to talk to each other and find a formal way for doing that, because, you know, the more we can't tell these stories, the more it takes an emotional toll on us. This is a humanizing book for neurosurgeons, because it restores that human component that is so hard to share, to know how to share with people that don't understand it. And it's so hard to tell those wonderful stories of patients and their families that need to be told, and to know the right way to do that. And I just want to, you know, thank you and congratulate you for introducing this. And I think it really should be a formal part. Just say, you know, with research, you know, I feel like research, we used to do a lot of case reports and things like that. And maybe part of this storytelling was a part of that, but it was never really good research. And research takes time, as you say in the book, and is about data and statistics, and there's a dehumanizing component to good research, but we have this need to tell stories, and maybe we need to uncouple those things, you know, and this book is one way I've seen doing that. But it's just shown to me how important it is to find a way amongst ourselves and amongst the public to be able to tell these stories. So thank you so much for sharing yours and showing us, you know, bridging that gap that I think, as Heather was saying and you were saying, has an emotional impact on our mental health if we don't do it. And is, I think, so needed in our field. So.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I will say that I think we all have stories in us. You know, I always say that there's you can walk around the hospital, you don't have to add any drama to it. There's stories walking down the hall. You know, there's more intercession in the cafeteria of a hospital than, you know, in many places on Sunday morning. and just because of these emotions lived. And, you know, as surgeons, we do tell stories. You know, the patient came to the operating room, general anesthesia was safely induced, and then we tell a narrative of the operation. And so, you know, maybe as we all think through things, we think about the narrative of not just the 18-year-old that presents with a ruptured AVM who was came to the emergency room for care, but the 18-year-old who was watching Harry Potter with her parents during the pandemic as part of the stay-at-home mandate, and, you know, fell into her bowl of Cheerios where they thought that she was kidding until they realized that she wasn't. And it's just not a huge leap for us. And we just have to come to terms with that green space, and then also a communal space of telling of stories. And I think that's really, really important for us to do as a field. So I would love to see more of this. I know that a lot of my colleagues have some wonderful stories to tell. And so, you know, who knows? One of your questions early on was like, you know, if there's going to be a next book. And I think, A, we have to see how this book does, you know, for Random House to be okay with it. But B, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see what our field has to say and what kind of stories our field has to tell. Because I think we all have a lot of stories to tell, a lot of journeys we've walked with our patients, a lot of lessons that we've learned.
I also think in some ways you sort of gave us permission to tell those stories, if not to one another, you know, because yep. I think one of the points you made is, you know, that sort of life is, you can't have the, you know, the highs without the lows and the good without the bad. And life is sort of in the mess of it all. The joy and the learning and the experiences where it all kind of comes together in the way you never anticipated and how you sort of work through that. And that kind of gives us permission by taking some of the judgment out of sharing these stories. And I think that's an important component as well.
Thank you. I appreciate that, Rob.
Well, I think that's a good ending for us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank all three of you guys. This was really fantastic. I really loved it. I love talking about it.
Yes, it was definitely the highlight of my week to get to talk to you and just
hands down, absolutely. Yes.
So I know the book is coming out in late June, and so we wish you luck with your tour. And I'm sure that people are really going to enjoy reading it. So thank you again.
Well, I sure do appreciate y'all taking the time to do it and letting me do it and reading it and giving me feedback on it. And I'm glad y'all enjoyed it. And I look forward to seeing you guys in the future, and have a good week. Yeah. Really, I'm very grateful for this. Thank you.
Yes. Get some sleep.
Yeah. Amen. I'm looking forward to hitting the sack.
Take care.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Jay. This was fantastic. And we'll see you here next week in Utah.
Yeah, so I'm so excited. Yeah,
we are too.
See you. Bye, Heather. Thank you.